hello, welcome back. That's some pleasant music. I don't know what that is. I suddenly felt rather tropical, like I wanted a pina colada in hand. Oh, whoever decided that's going to be the musical bed for the last time, I'm kind of for that. I'm just sort of, yeah, let's chill. Anyway, well, there you go. That's set the tone, hasn't it? That's sort of making me feel less panicked by the dystopian degradation of society at present. And unfortunately, though, I hope you did enjoy that musical bed, because that is the topic that we are sticking with. It's a topic everyone's messaging about. It's a topic everyone's talking about. And it's a topic, frankly, we do need to discuss with each other, if only to sort of relieve our panic and this sort of feeling of existential threat. And you'll be pleased to know I have two extremely esteemed people to join us in this communal catharsis. Baroness Claire Fox, who's the founder of the Academy of Ideas and a free speech enthusiast, a champion, if you will, and barrister and writer Stephen Barrett. Where to begin on all of this? Claire, let's start off with the concept of free speech and look at everything going on through the prism of free speech. And it seems to me that, you know, if you're inciting someone to go set fire to a hotel with human beings inside, it's very clear to me that as free as you might like speech to be, that probably should wind you up in trouble. Are you concerned here, though, that the thresholds of what we can say, what we can't say, the things we might discuss, the content we might share, is now under threat to a level that we should be in a kind of moral panic about it socially?
I think that the panic is not unfounded, I'm very sad to say. There is real anxiety. I think any of us who have followed the free speech issue can now be very concerned about. I think it's the willingness to see the worst in any speech and to arrest people, you know, for what could be seen as thought crimes is very nerve-wracking. But let's just be clear about it. Because the assaults on free speech in terms of the law have been quite widespread for a long time, I mean, even back in 2017, they were arresting hundreds of people a day for speech crimes, right, online. So it's not as though I want to pretend that this is new, but I think that the riots and the subsequent response to them seems to have given real sort of wind in the sails of the government to then not have any caution. And of course, that allows the police to round people up, as we've seen, and quite a lot of the people who have been sent to prison have been for what they've posted on social media. And as that's the public square where we all participate in discussion, then that makes everybody feel as though they've got to watch what they say at a time when we should be having more extensive, more wide-reaching conversations about why it is that this civil unrest has happened and what are the underlying problems that has led to this place that we're in. And yet we're not allowed to discuss it freely. That's very scary.
I think you're right. And I think that has sort of been building up as a pressure cooker and led to the explosions that we have seen. Now, I want to sort of talk about a specific case without talking about a specific case. I'm going to bring Stephen Barrett in, who is a barrister, to guide us through this factually and cautiously. There's been an arrest where someone's been taken to a police station. I understand she is a woman in her 50s who was making dinner, putting it on the table for her family when she was picked up by the boys in blue and taken into custody and kept there for 48 hours. And this is relating to the misidentification of the perpetrator of the Southport knife attack. This is what is being, I think, rather reductively chalked up as the cause of everything. I think that is a ridiculously simplistic viewpoint. Anyway, she happens to retweet or repeat the allegations against who the person might be and finds herself in police custody for two whole days while this is being investigated. She's not been charged yet, so we can talk about it a bit more freely. I find that very alarming because without, you know, I always say that we shouldn't see things through the prism of race and all the rest of it. But she doesn't really fit the profile to me of someone who's a danger to society with a network of fascistic far-right organisations who will go out and act on her command. My understanding is that when she had posted something and realised it was wrong, she took down the post and apologised for it. And yet she has been held in custody, a woman in a prison cell. And at the same time, I'm looking at the two lads in those videos from Manchester Airport, who we saw with our own eyes and videos circulating online, had inflicted a, you know, pretty horrific assault on police officers. And there they were on the BBC and on Sky News giving a blimmin' press conference, basically laying out their side of the story, you know, as free as anybody, sitting there in their suits, explaining that, you know, what had gone on, or at least having a solicitor do it, before any charge has been levelled, which in my mind will actually prejudice any case that ever might come if they were ever charged. Stephen, walk us through this. I mean, what is going on here? Has Sir Keir Starmer basically, with some of the things that are going on now, is he created a Pandora's box of dystopia that, for instance, you know, we're talking about if you're retweeting insightful material or fake news from an organisation that means us harm. I'm minded of what went on when the BBC spoke about the IDF missiling a hospital in Gaza, and then we found out actually it wasn't the IDF at all. It was a terrorist organisation in Gaza whose rocket had backfired, and this was Hamas propaganda, who are a terrorist organisation. And people retweeted that. People took to the streets because of that. That would have added to the terror threat level. And what's going on here? Where do you delineate all of this stuff?
Well, there is clearly no consistency in the application of rules. And if you want to restore a sense of order to the country, then you will need to have consistency in the application of rules. I'd go further than that. I think you also need to properly define rules. There's a new offence under the 2023 Act, Section 179, of sharing something that you know to be false with an intention to cause non-trivial harm. That's not really been fleshed out right yet. Was that a terribly useful offence to add to the lexicon? Is it terribly useful to create new criminal offences if the public at large are largely unaware of them? The public have become very detached from lawmaking. I mean, I am very old-fashioned, and I do remember how things were, and I do remember when we used to publish Acts of Parliament in bits of them in the Time, bills in the Time, so that people could read them over their Sunday breakfast or whatever, and have a think about the wording of the law. I'm not sure the society we live in now has anywhere near that level of public engagement with the law, but a sophisticated democracy must engage with the law. So the 2023 Act new offence of this knowingly sharing something that is false needs to be fleshed out. You're quite right about to be concerned about press conferences. I won't talk about live cases because, again, I'm old-fashioned. But it is really the job of the Attorney General and the Lord Chancellor, they're called the law officers, to maintain the justice system and maintain its integrity and to stop people having things like press conferences or talking about live cases. So if I suddenly started mouthing off about a live case, I would expect the Attorney General to burst through the door and shush me, because that is the role of the Attorney General. And it does feel as though those two law officers have forgotten that, and that's across successive governments. I don't think it's unique to this one in any way. We've lived in a society in which what rules mean has become very complicated and difficult and very far away from the average person. Whether rules are consistently applied seems to be fundamentally breaking down. And without those, we cannot have the rule of law.
Right. And I want to go back to you on that, Claire, because you were talking about, you know, this sort of neo-legislation and policing applying to everybody. And I think a lot of people out there are worried that that won't be the case. There's been a discussion about two-tier policing. I think people, perhaps wrongly, perhaps there's no need to panic, but I think people are worried that this isn't going to be applied with consistency, and it will only be applied to a certain subset of society, and that people, when it comes to this sort of these sort of prosecutions for whether something is fake news, whether it's inciting hatred, whether you knew that it was inciting hatred or whether it was fake news and all the rest of it, that we will end up with a two-tier judicial system. And, well, frankly speaking, if I was going to put it, you know, starkly, essentially that one lot of people will be persecuted and the other lot will be protected. Does that worry you?
I think you're absolutely right to be concerned. I think it takes the form of a kind of new version of us and them. I heard you having that kind of interesting discussion earlier about whether we should say left or right or what have you. But we do know that what's now happened is that through the course of the last couple of weeks, we've had defined as the kind of enemy within this supposed emergence of the far right, you know, the fascist EDL and their supporters, which is actually a misunderstanding, it seems to me, of what seemed to have been fairly spontaneous, localised riots. By the way, often with people participating in them who were criminals, who were openly racist and so on. So I'm not making that point. But if you then suggest to the British public that if you have certain views or express certain ideas or ask questions about particular topics like, for example, mass immigration or the rise of radical Islamism or any of these things, that you are can easily be put into the far right category, then it becomes easy to just simply dismiss those people as people who are, you know, the enemy that needs to be dealt with by the law. And so it's not even then understood that it's two-tier policing because they are the kind of main people you're targeting. And a good example of that, I think, just in terms of misinformation, was what happened in relation to Wednesday evening. We were told that there was intelligence, and we were told this by, you know, MPs, by the media, and by Hope Not Hate, an organisation that is, of course, on the right side of history, allegedly, so they would be trusted, that there was going to be 100 far-right demonstrations throughout the land. And this terrified people so much. It terrified many ordinary Muslims who thought they might be targeted. It terrified, you know, people so much that the GP surgery closed down, shops closed early, town centres were empty. And the next, and of course, nothing happened. All that happened was a load of stand up against racism protesters went out. And then they crowed about it the next day and said, we've beaten the far right off the streets. It was then admitted that probably that list was a hoax. Well, if it was maybe a hoax and it was put forward and popularised, a piece of misinformation popularised by the good guys, why aren't they being prosecuted in the same way as the woman in Cheshire that you just mentioned?
Yeah.
They've admitted it was probably a hoax. It led to fear. It led to mayhem. It led to people being frightened to leave their house. And it wasn't true. But the reason they got away with that, and this is all I'm saying, is it's now increasingly the case that there's two types of people. There's the good guys, and then there's the people that they can categorise as and delegitimise it as far right and, you know, fascist supporting. And this is so despicable because it actually silences legitimate conversations by making people dread having that label thrown at them.
I mean, on that, when you talk about the good guys and the bad guys, I think we know which category we would be put in. We're certainly not on the nice list, are we, according to these people who would rather we didn't have radio shows and didn't share our thoughts on social media. Now, I had a caller before the break who sort of said to me, well, you know, do you think... Well, it was someone who texted you, wasn't it, Rog? Who said, you know, you may be sort of laughing about it now or discussing it now, but just you wait. First, it'll be the ban of X, then they'll take Talk TV off air, then they're going to take
Twitter,
down GB News.
Then Telegram.
And, yeah, I mean, I don't know who to ask for all of this, so, but let's go back to Stephen on that. I mean, do you... Yeah, Roger, you go for it.
Yeah, I'd just like to suggest, if I may, that this could also be looked at from a somewhat different angle. I practiced law for many years in America and internationally, and I was... a law professor for a period, not that long. So I do understand a bit about these things. And, you know, I think that the mistake that we are making is that we're seeing this in a binary fashion. There's them and us, there's the good guys, the bad guys, there's black and white. My experience, especially in the law, of situations like this is that every time I look for a conspiracy or a plot or a plan, I end up looking at an incompetency. It's all nothing right. More than incompetence. And so I don't think that we will have two tiers of anything. I think we'll have multiple tiers. I think we'll have all kinds of miscarriages of justice, of different people being treated differently, sentenced differently, for different reasons, by different people carrying out the law in the way they see. It will be quite a mess for quite a while. Right. But it's not going to be a them and us thing.
Right. I mean, Stephen. Yeah, Claire, actually. Yeah. Claire, go for it.
Well, let me just clarify, because I am somebody who really can't stand conspiratorial thinking, and that's not what I was implying.
Yeah.
But there are narratives that come to dominate the way that we understand the society we live in. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there is a narrative emerging, which is a them and us situation. Yeah. Of course, I don't think that's true. Mm. I think that, of course, we have a multitude of people driven by a range of different, you know, ideas and so on. Mm. But if a narrative sticks, it can be very powerful. And this is the point about free speech. It's not just a legal restraint. You can be in a situation where you're frightened to speak, where you're watching, looking over your shoulder and so on.
Yeah.
We also know, sorry, just to finish this bit, we also know that the danger that we've got ourselves into is, and Alex, you and I understand this, the people who were involved in the Brexit rows over the years were called, absolutely traduced and smeared as racists and supporters of the far right, which it was used so promiscuously that it became meaningless to the point where we actually sometimes are in a situation where when there's real racism, you can't even say it because people say, oh, everyone says everyone's a racist. However, a narrative at the moment is basically saying there's a group of people who should be ignored because they're a problem. They're the enemy within. And I do think as that's coming from the top and is then being reinforced by the way the law is being applied, that is very dangerous to whole society.
Okay.
Let me just respond to that. You're absolutely right. I mean, I see this in my followers, in my social media contacts and followers. I used to get, Claire, two or three times a month messages like this. I now get them multiple daily. They used to come from, well, kind of nutters. Now they come from lawyers and bankers and CEOs and people. And they all say, and they've always been saying, Dr. Roger, it's time that you wake up and smell the coffee, okay? And this is what they used to say about the Tory government. Nobody can be this stupid. Nobody can make mistakes like this over and over and over again. This is a plot. It's Davos. It's the World Economic Forum. It's Davos. It's the Illuminati.
Right.
It's the Jews. It's the Muslims. Mm. It's the Martians. God, I mean, they all had different people, but they all said the same thing. You're right, Claire. There was that theme of the globalists versus the rest of us.
Yeah, I want to go back to Stephen because we've got to go to break soon. I really want to ask a barrister himself about what I think is going to be at the crux of all of this. You know, we've lost faith in mainstream media. We're concerned about two-tier policing. No one likes politics or politicians at all. But it's so important in a society that feels free, that doesn't feel frightened, that it doesn't lose faith in its justice system. And I think one of the things we're talking about here is whether the law is going to be applied equally and evenly, whether or not people might be targeted. And also when Claire talks about the sort of narrative shaping society that, to coin a favourite term of you know, the progressives, might create an unconscious bias among judges who are fallible humans and at the end of the day will make decisions on these things. Do we think there's cause for concern here? Because what we see is potentially a bugger's muddle of some sort of brand new case precedent being rushed through. And yeah, this narrative that, like Claire is saying, that, you know, the bad guys need to be punished. Can we trust that our legal system will be even-handed and objective and that we're not going to find ourselves suddenly in a sticky situation because of the politics we might have?
When I was born, I was born into a country that was blessed with incredibly strong and robust institutions. All of those institutions were made robust because of a concept called impartiality. I'm afraid many of those institutions have fallen, but the top of the absolute apex of the pyramid is our judiciary, and they are in no way in danger of falling. We still have the best judges in the world. I have quite a lot of faith that this new offence from 2023, when it plays out in the courts, that the idea that you had to know that the fact was false will prove quite a good defence to people who make comments. I have quite a lot of faith that when it comes to incitement, which is currently encouraging or assisting, that encouraging and intentionally encouraging will be interpreted in quite a restrictive way so that we're not all caught, we're not all suddenly criminals. I would say, I mean, we can't just have blind faith in the judiciary, so we do need to pay attention to them. Mm. And it is this concept of impartiality, which I bang on a lot about, that if you want to restore institutions, restore impartiality, one of the things that the very politicised people do is they immediately say, well, you're criticising the BBC, for example, just to take an institution which has issues with impartiality. You're criticising it because you hate it. That's not true. I might love the BBC and want its impartiality restored. There's a third path They always assume that, that there are only two parts, because they see the world in such a right. diametrically opposed way. And the other thing on conspiracy theories, I'm afraid they abound because there are lots of tolerated conspiracy theories. So I'm afraid if you believe, and there do seem to be rather a lot of quite interesting people who genuinely believe that Elon Musk sent a tweet and it started a riot in the UK.
Yeah.
If you believe that, then you are a conspiracy theorist, because that is quite clearly nonsense.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. We've been too reductionist. Look, I've really got to go to bed, but I've got one more burning question, so we're going to have to make it quick, and it's going to go to you, Stephen, which is, it's been reported that Shemima Begum is going to now go to the good old ECHR to try and overturn the sort of stripping of her nationhood here in the United Kingdom and try and come home. I mean, she's run out of opportunities in the UK justice system. Now, of course, the ECHR, so that's a bit of a tug of war, that one. That's a thorny and divisive political issue. Do you think that the judge of the ECHR, which largely, when it comes to precedent on this, have taken the view of, well, you know, this person can't be stateless, this person cannot be stuck in a refugee camp, it's not safe for them, and they committed this offence as a minor. To me, it's got all the hallmarks of the sort of thing the ECHR would likely say to Britain, you've got this wrong. Mm. But given how loaded the whole concept of the ECHR is like, now, is it conceivable that Sir Keir Starmer will pick up the blow and be like, look, you want to be doing what we say right now, or we're going to be in one hell of a mess?
Yes, I think that's right. And when I praise our judges, I mean our judges, and I don't mean the inhabitants of that office block in Strasbourg. They are not, as far as I'm concerned, really a court. Right. And it's quite possible that they would simply bow to political pressure. Whatever the outcome actually should be, they will simply... And we know this. We negotiated with them on the prisoner voting case.
Good
you can't
them.
Negotiate with a proper court. A court gives an answer and you do as you're told. You know, it's not a negotiation. But anyway, whether people want to belong to the ECHR or not is their personal political opinion. I do point out that those who defend it usually fall back to effectively saying, well, what about our international reputation? Mm. Well, if you look at the UK as a whole, right now, our international reputation is absolute trash.
Yeah, and in no small part because of the ECHR, some might argue. Yeah, no, really interesting and fascinating debate with two brilliant guests there, Claire Fox and Stephen Barrett. I went well over time for that because it was really worth having all of those discussions, wasn't it? I hope you enjoyed it. Right, don't go anywhere, because when I come back, we're going to be shining a light on what is going on in Bangladesh. It's not